The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Yeah, but this is the exact mentality that got us to where we are, constantly thinking that no matter what we do, it's going to provoke Russia. We can't do that. It's going to provoke Russia. Let's re-engage. Let's have a reset. Let's not provoke Russia. Well, guess what? Russia is provoked on its own, you know, and I think we need to stop thinking like that. And I take the point in the no-fly zone. I don't think that's an idea that's going over. What about, as one of my colleagues at SIPA recently said, a we-fly zone, right? Like, we're going to protect these civilian corridors, and you want to shoot us down? Go ahead.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 7th, 2022. The Russian invasion of Ukraine continues full blast with a great deal of brutality, a great deal of destruction, and indeterminate levels of success. We brought together in front of a Lawfare live audience an incredible panel to talk about it. Alina Polyakova of the Center for European Policy Analysis, Tomas Ilves, former president of Estonia, Dmitry Alperovich, the head of the Silverado Policy Accelerator, Alex Vindman, the Pritzker Military Fellow at the Lawfare Institute, and Dominique Bastios, also of Lawfare. We talked about how the Russian incursion is going. Are the Russians succeeding or are they falling short? We talked about the European opposition. How firm is it? How debilitating to the Russian economy is it? And we took questions from a live audience. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 7th. Russia's Ukraine operation, 1 week in. Alina, get us started here. We've got a whole lot of stuff has happened over the past week. How would you describe the lay of the land today, both in Ukraine and internationally with respect to the conflict?
Thanks, Ben, and thanks for getting us all together on this again. I always get the opening question. It's so hard to put it all together because the situation is changing so rapidly. But in Ukraine, it's bad. It's really, really bad. And what I mean by that is the Ukrainian forces are, of course, performing better than most people expected. The Ukrainian people are proving themselves to be not just courageous, but incredibly brave and resilient. And certainly, I don't think the Russians expected this kind of resistance, as we've heard many times. But over the last several days, we've seen a very aggressive front. I think there's been a signal of a change in strategy. In fact, it looks very likely that over the next days, very, very soon, the Russians will close kind of the north attack and the south attack, which will basically close the country's east completely. They've also been attacking nuclear power plants. And we know that. I don't think the reason for those attacks in Zaporizhia, for example, which is Europe's largest nuclear power plant located there, is to destroy the power plant, just to shut it down and to deprive, you know, hundreds of thousands of people of heat, electricity, et cetera. So what we're looking at, I think, is increasingly looking like a huge humanitarian disaster. So the million plus refugees that we've seen go to Europe already across Ukraine's western border is just the beginning, in my view. They're going to squeeze the country, but really bringing the pain onto the civilians. That's what it looks like. And I'm afraid they're also looking at a massive bombing campaign of US major cities, including Kiev, and others that have been holding out. And I think on the international community side, yes, we've seen some very assertive, very fast-paced policy decisions being made by the EU, especially on economic sanctions, personal sanctions. We're seeing the US go after specific individuals that are close to Putin, and not just them, but their relatives, which is really key here. We're also seeing the sanctions really taking toll. The Russian markets haven't opened yet. They're likely will remain closed through at least middle of next week because they're afraid of what is likely to come. And on the economic side, we've also seen this beginning of a pretty massive corporate exodus from Russia as well. But all of these things combined together are not enough to stop Russia's current offensive. It's not going to save Ukraine. And I still fear that despite everything we're doing to supply weapons to Ukraine, which there is now a flow of weapons to Ukraine, it's becoming increasingly difficult to get them through Ukraine. We've also had an agreement, supposed agreement, to establish some humanitarian corridors between the Ukrainian and the Russian side. But history has taught us that Russians don't respect these corridors. So of course, I have a concern, deep concern, the Russians will, even if they agree to it in principle, will still bomb civilian roadways, also the same roads. If any of you have driven through from Kiev, let's say to Western Ukraine, those are some really bad roads there in some parts. They're the only roads that also weapons are going in on and civilians are going out on as well. So I think the potential for safe passage is actually not very high. So those are the kinds of things that have been happening the last couple of days. But unfortunately, I think this is just the beginning. It's going to get far, far worse.
On that cheerful note, Tomas, you are in one of the frontline states. How nervous are people in the Baltics, in Poland, in Eastern Europe in general about the potential for escalation here?
First of all, I'm in Latvia tonight, so.
Ah, the point still stands.
No, well, I mean, people are not afraid. I think the dominant emotions are, first of all, incredible sympathy, empathy, and compassion for the refugees. And we're taking a lot in and trying to do a lot. We just announced a 400 places in the National University to be paid for by us for Ukrainian university students. Our police meet them at the border and give all the kids stuffed toys and candy. So, I mean, it's kind of like this thing we want to help. And we have an amazing outpouring, but this is true, I think, across the region, that when the refugees come, I mean, we don't have refugee camps. I saw an article today, where are the refugee camps in Poland? This is like, because the Poles take them in. We take them in. I mean, we don't have a problem. So there's an immense outpouring in that sense. The second sign is that we have a National Guard, and for that you have to go do a physical exam, and the doctors are overbooked with people wanting to join the National Guard. I mean, I guess that shows the other side of it. So there's not much anxiety or fear at this point. So there is anger at Russia for doing this. I mean, that's quite clear. And there is also a real uptick in people coming from Russia to the Baltic countries, and I imagine probably also to Poland, trying to get out. Now, I don't know what the figures are for today, but I know since there was this fear that the borders would be shut down, that people were scrambling to get to Finland and Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are the sort of direct borders to the EU, and I imagine that in Poland and Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, I have no figures, but I imagine something similar, that in addition to the refugees who are trying to get out, via the land borders to Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, and Romania. There are also a lot of Russians trying to get out also from Russia before the crackdown comes. And on top of that, we do know that the Russian border guards are checking people's their mobile phones to see whether they have any suspicious apps. I mean, it's getting real. It seems to be moving towards a real sort of totalitarian regime there, even more so. Plus, with all of the shutdowns of all of Western social media, BBC kicked off, Radio Free Europe. So it's getting grim.
So, Dmitry, it seems to me we're dealing with a race situation, right? Does the devastation of the Russian economy and the capacity of Russians to move money produce a change in policy or regime before Ukraine collapses? Do you have any reason for optimism that at least in the short term, Putin does not win that race?
No, and you know, I should caveat that I was born in Russia, so I'm never optimistic and have a long history of studying Russia to never be optimistic. But no, the reality is that sanctions will take their time to decimate the Russian economy. Russia is clearly moving very rapidly towards a North Korean-like isolation, both diplomatically and economically, but it's not going to feel it, the majority of that pain right away. And the reality is, on the ground, the Russian forces are probably a day or two from fully surrounding Kyiv. They're already on the outskirts of Kyiv from the west. They have been there for some time now, and they're now approaching it from the east as well. And from that point forward, I think there's going to be Grozny, capital of Chechnya, style campaign to pulverize Kyiv. I think that it's going to be even worse than Grozny, potentially, in the decimation that that city is going to take from Russian artillery, airstrikes, and ground forces, and they're going to be fighting for every street. And it'll probably take a month or so for them to fully take it, but there's no way that the Russian economy will fully collapse before then. You know, the one thing that I think is important to point out is that despite the valiant resistance of the Ukrainians, the Russians have actually made a lot of gains. And I actually did the math on the rate of their advance. It's actually in many areas twice the rate of the advance of the U.S. forces in Iraq in 2003. So if you remember the dash to Baghdad from Kuwait, it was about 550 kilometers. It took the U.S. 2 weeks to get there. The Russians have done 400 kilometers to Mariupol in about 5 days from the initial invasion, about 300 kilometers to Mykolaiv in the south. So they're actually moving really, really fast against a military that's actually much more motivated than the Iraqis were in 2003, armed with better weaponry, Western weaponry, than the Iraqis were. So in many ways, they've done fairly impressively, despite the fact that the planning, the logistics, the communications, the lack of EW, the lack of until recently, air support has been very, very poor on their part. Overall, I give them a C for their invasion progress up till now. But nevertheless, they're still making progress and taking good chunks of Ukraine pretty rapidly.
Alex, do you agree with Dmitry's military assessment that the Russian forces have actually performed better than they're being given credit for in the West? Is the situation quite as dire as Dmitry suggests?
I'm going to disagree with Alina and Dmitry actually on this, because I don't think the situation looks anywhere near as dire. Threats actually in the short term were for Kyiv, and the fact that the Russians pushed a significant amount of force to capture Kyiv really quickly. And those forces ran into a bottleneck around Kyiv and were stalled. And then in engaging in the fight, they needed resupply, significant numbers of food, ammunition, fuel, and those weren't coming in because they were both in the bottleneck, and the Ukrainians were effective at attacking him. They also haven't made much progress around Kharkiv. They're bypassing Kharkiv. They're bypassing a lot of strong points and basically extending their lines of communication that are unsecured. And the Ukrainians operating in small groups can still strike those. And there's plenty of evidence of this going on relatively consistently. Where the biggest progress is made, of course, is in the south, which kind of makes sense because the morale of the forces in the South is a lot better compared to where in the North. Those are Eastern Military District troops that were parked in the cold for a long time, thinking that they were just going to roll through as peacekeepers. In the South, these are forces that were being positioned in Crimea for a long period of time. The weather is better, clear skies. They could make quite a bit of headway. And they've made their biggest gains thus far have been seizing Kherson, which is a medium-sized city as opposed to sometimes described as a large city. And they've certainly encircled Mariupol and are going to, unfortunately, they're probably going to reduce Mariupol within the matter of days in spite of valiant resistance. But they've taken a beating. They've taken a beating with regards to, most importantly, their first echelon units. The First Guards Tank Army, which is basically the first armored division, the premier unit, has sustained significant casualties. At least one of the brigades in this army, which there's three plus brigades, is not combat effective anymore. And they've taken some damage on some other elements of that First Guards Tank Army. The Fourth Tank Army has been beaten up, another frontline unit, but they have overwhelming force, overwhelming firepower. They have lots of vehicles. The things where it gets harder for them are the support system, not the trucks that are providing kind of resupply, but the fuelers, the engineer vehicles, the signals vehicles, electronic warfare vehicles. They've taken some losses there also. And the Ukrainian Air Force is still operational. The air defense systems are degraded, but still operational. And at the same time, you have javelins and stingers coming in, not in the quantities that they need, insufficient. You might have to take two or three shots to take out an aircraft with a stinger. They have nowhere near that kind of number. But the human toll has been devastating because the Russians have been indiscriminate after about day five or six, adjusting from what was originally Putin's initial plan is out the window. It was supposed to be a kind of a lightning strike to secure the cities, replace the political leadership, then relatively quickly leave with minimal forces there. It's supposed to soften the blow of a backlash, and it was supposed to avoid the potential for this, having to fight an insurgency. So now he's fighting an insurgency, just a nascent insurgency that's starting. He still needs to move towards the cities, surround the cities, and then penetrate the cities. And there's a saying in the military, cities eat armies. It takes an enormous amount of combat power because once you start pulling into cities, each window, kind of each a pile of rubble is a potential vulnerability with regards to anti-tank systems and air defense systems. So it's going to be a difficult slog. I would say that we will see how much more damage they take over the next couple of days, but they're burning through a lot of their units really quickly. They had 70% of their combat power arrayed on Ukraine's borders in terms of the ground forces. It's a ground force military. And they committed more than 70% of that force to Ukraine already while suffering losses. So they don't have a huge amount of reserve force to pull in on. And certainly it's not the same kind of level of training and preparedness. We could see some of that unfold with regards to conscripts being forced into service. A lot of folks, depending on, not in the South, but in the East and North, a fair bit of surrendering, lots of examples of vehicles being destroyed. Some estimates are 300 in the ballpark of 200 tanks or more, multiply that by armored vehicles. So it's been really, really difficult. And the Russian military is taking a punishment. But I'll just wrap by saying this is far from being done. This is going to play out over a longer period of time because the Russians have a massive superiority in air power. They have lots of long range fires, ballistic missile brigades. That they're going to fire at cities to destroy the will of the Ukrainian people to resist. And the question is, frankly, does the West have the fortitude to follow Turkey's lead and provide some capabilities to strike these assets, strike airfields that are housing these aircraft, helicopters, and planes, and strike these ballistic missile batteries that are firing? And that could be really change the kind of the picture if they get them in sufficient quantities.
All right. We have a really interesting dispute here about the military situation, which I want to return to. But before we do, Dominic, I want to ask you about Russian domestic opinion. Over the last week, we have seen large protests in a bunch of different cities. We've seen a bunch of different large numbers of detentions and arrests. And yet yesterday, there was a flurry of journalism of people interviewing Russians in the street who were fiercely supportive of Putin. What, if anything, do we know about what the state of Russian domestic opinion on this subject?
So it's difficult to know what exactly Russian domestic opinion is right now because we don't have a lot of good sociological polling data yet. We haven't seen centers like Levada go out and ask what people's opinion is of the war, or they can't actually say war now. They'll just ask them, I guess, ostensibly their opinion of the special operation in Ukraine. But from what we do know and what we have seen right now, there have been a couple of different responses to the war in Ukraine. And that has been somewhat of a rally around the flag effect among those who have already been watching state media, who are already exposed to the constant flow of propaganda. The state has been putting out these videos to show to children in schools and so on and so forth that is just perpetuating the same narrative of demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine. And that seems to land with some people who don't have access to other information. That problem is becoming worse as a result of what Tomas referenced earlier, just kind of this grim situation we see right now with the media in Russia. As it stands, the last vestiges of independent media are really going by the wayside. Those that haven't been blocked are being throttled. That includes Medusa, Dozhd, Radio Echo in Moscow, BBC Russian Service, Radio Svoboda and all of its regional subsidiaries, Current Time, Voice of America, New Times, Doxa, Deutsche Welle, Znak, Facebook, Twitter, App Store, Google Play, Steam. I mean, it's really just kind of an unprecedented crackdown, even for what already was an extremely autocratic state. And it's very grim, as Tomas referenced earlier. And as Dmitry and Alina spoke about previously, the economic situation is also something that's just going to be horrific, probably worse than the 1998 Russian financial crisis, because there aren't going to be the same prospects for immediate improvement. They're being disconnected from the external global economy. The energy transfers still exist, but even that is something that's been put on the table for potential next round of sanctions. We haven't seen the immediate impacts of those things, but in another couple of weeks from now, the open question is, how do people start to respond when the socioeconomic situation becomes extremely dire? And really, for those who have contacts on the ground in Russia, some are already aware of what's coming. And in some ways, the Russian economy is sort of like the Titanic. It's already sinking. Some have already figured out that it's happening and they're choosing to get on the lifeboats now. But a lot of other people still remain unaware because they don't have access to good information, or because as a result of constant exposure to state propaganda, they question the veracity of any kind of claims to the contrary to their worldview that they're presented with.
Thomas?
There is a, first of all, there's a piece in the BBC today, rather depressing, about Russians or Ukrainians, I don't know, it depends, living in Ukraine who see what's going on and who are being bombed and whose parents living in Russia with access only to the Russian media do not believe them. They do not believe their own children and say you're lying. And this seems to be a broader problem. And I think one of the drawbacks of, or one of the results of all of the shutting all the alternative forms down is that there is no alternative information. And today when Scholz spoke with, as I mentioned, I think Scholz spoke with Putin and Putin said, it's all lies. The videos of what's going on in Kiev are fakes. So, I mean, we're really moving into a NORC situation where people just get no other information and that's what they believe. And with the shutdown of Western media, this will be exacerbated.
So I want to return to the dispute over the military situation. Dmitry and then Alina, why are you confident? You both were you know, opened with a very dispiriting account of the military situation with which Alex disagreed pretty diametrically. Why are you confident that you're right and he's wrong?
Well, the first thing that's important to understand is that there are two effectively phases to this invasion. The first phase was just terribly dumb, for the lack of better word, because it was based on the faulty assumption that the Ukrainian forces would just melt away, go home, and you can drive to Kiev with literally a company of armored vehicles and take Zelensky. That failed miserably. They've gotten slaughtered and taken heavy losses as a result of that. The whole airborne assault on the Antonov airport was a total disaster for them. But around fourth, fifth day, they switched tactics. They realized that this was not going to work. And they started going with overwhelming force. They started to surround cities. They started to lob missiles and even multiple launch rocket systems into cities. They started to aggregate significant armor and not do these suicidal small unit tactics. So the reality is, if you look at where they are today, basically on the eighth day or ninth day of the invasion, they've taken much of the southwest. They basically have their bridge to Crimea from the Donbas area. The only thing that's standing in their way is the city of Mariupol, which they're going to take probably, as Alex said, with complete decimation of that city. They've driven pretty far up north in that southwest region up to Zaporozhye. So that's where the nuclear power plant is that they targeted yesterday with some mortar strikes. And yes, they haven't taken Kharkiv. They haven't taken Sumy. There have been some significant battles there, as well as Chernihiv in the northeast. But it's not clear to me that they're actually trying to take those cities right now. It seems like they're surrounding them and trying to decimate them with air strikes and artillery. But the key thing that's really they're making a lot of progress on is surrounding Kyiv with massive forces. Yes, it's been slow advance. Yes, they've had a lot of logistical issues. But the reality is they've been able to aggregate tens of thousands of troops now in Kyiv. There's pretty significant battles happening on the western side of Kyiv, in Irpin, which is literally about 10 miles from the center of Kyiv. They're now in the city of Baryshevka, or village of Baryshevka, I should say, which is about 30 miles from the center of Kyiv on the eastern side, very close to Borispol Airport, which they're probably going to go after next. So they're making steady progress. Yes, it's probably a lot slower than they expected. The initial plan was a disaster. But the reality is that the Ukrainians will not be able to hold them off for a significant period of time. They have overwhelming force advantage. And even though their air campaign has been a total disaster, and Alex is absolutely right, Ukrainian Air Force is still flying. Most of the runways, I just looked at SAR imagery a couple of days ago, most of the runways are still operational, which is just puzzling to me that they haven't even attempted to shut those down. But they're still making significant progress, inflicting significant casualties on the Ukrainian military, even though they're taking significant casualties themselves as well.
Lena.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, you know, neither Dmitry and I, if I can speak from our, you know, military analysts here, you know, we're just looking at the facts on the ground, trying to make sense of them. But also, you know, talking to people who are on the ground in Ukraine, a lot of the war reporters that are still in Kyiv, reading what the reality is, you know, and I don't want to be saying this, trust me, but I don't think anything is sacred anymore for the Russians. You know, I used to think that they wouldn't touch Kyiv in a real way, because that is the heart of ancient Rus. And one of the most sacred Orthodox, Russian Orthodox sites is in Kyiv. But I think they're done. I think they're done because they've been frustrated for too long. They thought they were gonna, you know, as Dmitry said, do this quickly, easy walk in the park. Now we see that the soldiers that are following, like some of the reports from Kherson, you know, they're not the soldiers who are saying that they didn't know what they were getting into. They didn't know what to expect. They're not crying. You know, these are like, they know what they're facing. They're ready for the fight. I think information is probably spread around the Russian military. And who knows if they were given information in advance to say they didn't know what was going on, didn't know where they were going. That seems really far-fetched to me, frankly, but now outside the realm of possibilities. So I just think Putin is all in. He's also probably looking at, you know, a very basic calculus that, you know, the sanctions are ratcheting up. They're not hitting in his direct, you know, ability to carry out the war now, but they will. You know, they have lost the ability to use that reserve to prop up the economy.
Forget it done now.
Yeah, they might run out of money, frankly. I mean, I've seen some really crazy estimates about how much this war effort is costing the Russians right now. I have no idea how accurate these estimates are, but they range to like $20 billion a day in overall losses. I mean, how long can you sustain that, you know? So I think they see a window. They know they have to get it. They're not pulling back. And this is a learned, tried and true strategy they've carried out multiple times in Syria. They tested in Chechnya. You know, they know how to do this, and they will do it. I think they're done with, you know, the kids' gloves.
Tomas has a question for Alex.
Yeah, just something on this very confused situation with planes from the West. Poland, Slovakia, and Bulgaria were going to give MiGs and Sukhois, I guess, or to Ukraine. And then they said, we're not going to give it. And I was just at a sort of military security conference at the Baltic Defense College this last 2 days. And there, the word was that, oh, we were told, rather, Stoltenberg told us we couldn't do it. And I'm going like, what? I mean, Stoltenberg is the Secretary General, which is just a secretary. He works for the Allies, not the other way around. And I don't understand how he can tell countries, no, you can't do that. And where it gets just odd is that while everyone, including we here in Estonia, are sending massive, all kinds of stuff, you know, sort of howitzers, javelins, lots of javelins, and this is happening across the Allies. So how does a plane differ from a javelin except in size? I don't understand, especially because the MiGs and the Sukhois that were promised initially are the only planes actually that where the Ukrainian pilots don't need any training to fly them. I mean, so what's the problem?
I don't have anything definitive, but I've been told that the U.S. basically obstructed this provision of air power because they thought it was too provocative. You have to understand that, and I continue to engage with, you know, some of my relationships that I've had over the years, and there's still a great deal of wishful thinking about somehow some sort of return to normalcy, and a lack of recognition of the fact that we're in a protracted Cold War and headed towards a hot war if not enough is done to kind of to avoid that outcome. And to me, that outcome becomes increasingly probable as this war extends over the course of weeks and potentially months, because I don't think it's going to be it's going to be very short. Certainly, all those safe havens from Western Ukraine are currently not even touched, and supplies could filter in there largely unaffected. So the thinking from the administration is this is still limited. There's not enough recognition of the fact that this is already had spillover in some significant ways, you know, whether that's like last night in acute situation and a nuclear disaster, or the disrupted foodstuffs that were supposed to be exported elsewhere, the massive refugee flows. I mean, it's already expanded beyond, it's spilled over. It just hasn't spilled over in military means. And Russia's response to the sanctions is to either sit back or do what Vladimir Putin prefers to do, which is escalate. So we could see a response there in the form of cyber or any number of different things. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking about it. And I don't think this is a done deal with these planes yet. I think the things that seemed unpalatable 3 or 4 or 5 days ago are increasingly looking palatable. If people start to think a little bit deeper about the bad decisions that are going to be compelled by populations that are going to look at what's going on the ground and the humanitarian disaster, and the kinds of decisions they might be forced to make there with supporting no-fly zones, which probably is not a good idea, those decisions are going to be a lot tougher in the future. But there are things that we could do that are not actually as provocative. Certainly, what you pointed out is one of them. transferring over planes, Soviet era Warsaw Pact planes to Ukraine is one of them. And the Ukrainians could employ them immediately. These Mi-8 helicopters that were destined for Afghanistan, easy. Just cut through the bureaucracy in DOD and state, send them over. And these are not just lift platforms. These are actually, these have weapons pods. So they could be employed immediately. And then of course, this thing that I've been, you know, pushing on, because again, the people I've been talking to, this would fill a critical need, with these UCAVs, the unmanned combat aerial vehicles, that could really kind of start to even the score in a lot of different ways. It's not just air to ground capability, it's air to air capabilities that they could come with. So knocking out Russian planes, where there's a vast majority, knocking out helicopters and knocking out ballistic missiles that are devastating cities. This has definitely not gone anywhere near to plan, but it's gone in terms of ground covered, it's gone relatively quickly. But these are porous lines right now. There is not a lot of depth. There's not a lot of security. And the smartest thing they probably could have done, to a certain extent, although it's politically untenable, is they could have probably pulled back their forces. It's politically untenable, just to be clear. But they could have pulled back their forces and kind of gained the kind of ground that they needed steadily, secured it against ambushes and raids, secured it against punishing air attacks, whether that's, you know, through this limited number of TB2s or the existing Ukrainian Air Force. But they're not going to do that. They're going to try to smash these cities as quickly as possible. And they're in a certain way, they don't have the force. They may not have the force. I can't say that quite definitively, but we'll see pretty soon whether they do. I think that they may not end up having the force they need to take these massive cities.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep
acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. Dominic has a question for Dimitri, and I have a question for Alina, and then we are going to go to the audience.
So Dimitri, as this continues, the longer this goes on, in some ways it feels like this is becoming an existential conflict for both the Ukrainian state as well as Putin's regime. And one of the things you've spoken about previously is the potential for a palace coup. Already we've seen several oligarchs, Friedman, Mardashov, and I believe the other was Deripaska, speak out. Lukoil has spoken out. There have been several other groups of prominent Russian figures that have spoken out. What do you currently evaluate as the possibility for pushback from within the regime itself? And where do you think those elements are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first thing that's important to understand is that the oligarchs actually don't have any political power in Russia. That changed after Putin came to power. Famously, during the Yeltsin era, they really controlled all the strings of power. And they, you know, like Berezovsky, for example, now deceased, were the ones that actually convinced Yeltsin at the time to pick Putin as a successor. The first thing that Putin did when he came to power is told these people, you can continue to make money. You can continue to make a lot of money under my regime, you will not interfere in politics. So stay out of it. And famously, Khodorkovsky did not listen to that and ended up in jail and losing much of his wealth. The others did. And now they have very little power left in Russia. So whatever they're saying publicly really is irrelevant. The people that Putin relies on for his hold on power now more than ever is really the security forces and the military. So what I'm looking for is any potential fissures in that establishment, the Silovy key faction of the Russian military and intelligence services, that will decide that they're personally being hit substantially by these economic sanctions. And what I would love to see from the administration is actually more sanctions, not just on the oligarchs, that's fine, but really on the general officers, even colonels in the Russian military, in the Russian intelligence, going after their families as well, trying to make sure that they personally get hit significantly by these economic sanctions. And that can really create pressure on them in a way that other things may not, when they'll realize that these sanctions are not going away no matter what happens in Ukraine, as long as Vladimir Putin is in power. And the only way that to potentially change that situation is to tell the old man to go. I want to be very clear, still a tiny, tiny chance that this will actually happen. But I don't think it's zero anymore, as it would have been, I think, even a few weeks ago. So there's a real threat now to Putin, minor one, but one that he has to be very mindful of, particularly as he is really cracking down on all opposition. He's shut down now the last remaining media left in Russia, just passed this law, draconian law, actually signed it. Duma passed it last night that basically prohibits anti-war protests. It prohibits any reporting on the war that is negative to the Russian military. So it is now fully on dictatorship. There's no doubt about it. All the pretense is gone. But he needs the security forces to keep it in line. And if they decide it's not in their best interest personally to continue doing so, they can orchestrate a coup. Now, this will not be sort of a Navalny becomes president coup, right? This will be another hardliner that may pursue very similar policies, at least in terms of domestic repression, but they may decide that it's time to try to ease things a little bit with the West.
Okay, before we go to audience questions, I want to ask Alina and Tomas. Alina first, I think you both were at the Munich Security Conference. We've seen a complete revolution in European attitudes toward and American attitudes toward NATO from the last administration, but in European attitudes toward dealing with Russia. To what extent is this a momentary reaction? And to what extent do you think the scales are off European eyes, or I should say Western European eyes, because they were never really on Eastern European eyes? And, you know, should we see this as a major realignment that has long-term implications or a short-term response to a crisis?
Well, I mean, I think it's too early to say, honestly. I know that's a bit of a cop-out answer, but I think certainly we've seen some pretty significant changes in European defense and security policy, Germany being the top most surprising change to me. I mean, they've basically gone in the complete other direction, and public opinion has followed political leadership, which I think has been a really welcome sign, but a surprising sign. Other countries have announced that they will be increasing their percentage of GDP that they commit to defense spending over the next several years. Public opinion is shifting very, very quickly, but it's hard to know, one, how long this kind of united front stands. I mean, what's interesting is that we've been in this long debate about, is Russia a threat? Is it a partner? Should we work with them? Are they allies? You know, should we engage? Should we reset? And now there's really no debate. And that's because Mr. Putin has just very clearly showed himself to be the brutal monster that he is. And that has united Europe. And I also think it's important to point out that those of you who are in the States, and I think President Lewis can speak to this even more directly, it feels very real if you're in Europe. Even in Western European countries, people are hosting refugees, obviously not at the level of Poland, Romania, Moldova, Hungary, et cetera. But it feels very real. War feels very real to Europeans in a way that it doesn't feel in the same way if you're in the United States. So I hope, my hope is that this is a long-term structural change in European security and defense policy. And on top of that, that this might lead to this kind of alliance solidarity that we've also seen with the United States has been very profound. And we haven't seen that in a very long time. I can't remember the last time we saw this kind of solidarity between the transatlantic alliance. And I hope that we can stick to that and channel that into other productive ways. Like on China, for example, we had a long debate as well with Europeans, all kinds of different issues where we have been diverging and decoupling. I also hope this kills the strategic autonomy debate, because this has just exposed, you know, how completely dependent Europe is on NATO and the United States in particular when there's a real military threat on its border. So the whole idea that, you know, Europe can now move towards some sort of strategic decision making without having the hard power behind it, I think has been exposed to be false. I think there's a lot of really difficult questions ahead, especially on the trade-offs between security and energy or just economic growth more broadly. And on the bigger question of the reality that I think now, you know, we all see that democratic values and principles have to have hard power behind them. I mean, that is a difficult thing to swallow for many, many Europeans who wanted to ride it out on leadership around norms, principles, and international rules. And now the Russians have basically said, screw you. And that has changed the world order in a profound way.
Thomas?
I would date the end of the post-Cold War era that began somewhere between 1989 autumn and or to the other end, maybe sort of December 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. That era ended on the 24th of February, which unfortunately is also the Estonian Independence Day, but that it is a complete changeover. Okay, Alina mentioned the dramatic change in the entire German posture. And I'm sure Constanze Stelzenberger has talked and written about the speech that Scholz gave on Sunday, which got a standing ovation from everybody but the neo-Nazis in the German parliament, where he talked about raising defense expenditures to over 2%. We have massive support for that across the board and in Germany especially, which was very pacifist and against defense expenditure. We have seen which I will be interesting to follow, is that in both Finland and Sweden, which had very small, 20% supported joining NATO over all these past years. And the leaders always said, oh, well, we can't do anything because the public isn't behind us. And now you have 51% in one study today in Sweden and 53% where the against is much, much lower than the 50s. Because a lot of people also don't know. So, I mean, we have the Nordic countries suddenly have crawled out of their sort of non-allied status. We have seen one of the more dubious figures in Europe, Orban, now supporting everything, having blocked NATO aid to Ukraine for years, having blocked EU aid to Ukraine. He's beginning to see that he knows which way the wind blows. So he doesn't need a weatherman. So I think this is a profound change. And public opinion, once it shifts dramatically like this, is not going to simply flip back, I don't think. I mean, this kind of, this kumbaya approach that we have seen for 30 years, pardon me, but that's the way it's been, in which the Western part of Europe at least slept through the Georgian invasion and sort of wrote it off and immediately ignored it. The 2014 annexation, again, completely sort of bypassed and sort of, oh, well, that was a one-off with some minor sanctions. This is big. And the thing is that, you know, Ukraine is a big country. It is a disgusting war that people see all the time on social media. The scenes have been horrific. And if you've followed those, that is not going to go away real fast. So I think we're in it for a long haul. I don't think it'll dissipate that quickly.
Just want to quickly come in and say, I think it's indicative of a broader geopolitical shift, frankly, and this idea that democracies will stand up for each other. I think it's too early to say definitively where this ends up, but if Ukraine leaves with its, even devastated with its sovereignty and independence intact, you know, at the end of a very punishing war that grinds down both sides, then, and these sanctions, you know, remain, it actually likely diminishes scenarios, certainly in China's calculation for, let's say, a Taiwan scenario. It does not want to be, you know, even though it's a second largest economy in the world, there are lessons to draw from this, and there are lessons to draw for other authoritarian regimes. The authoritarian regimes that are typically not really reflective on their own shortfalls will wonder, you know, how this went so wrong in so many different ways, and how a country like Russia, superpower, is isolated. So I think this is going to have a chilling effect on this surge of authoritarianism to a certain extent also.
All right, Genevieve Della Fera, the floor is yours.
Hello, I would like to ask Colonel Vindman if the assassination attempts signal a desperation from Russia, or is this merely business as usual, considering that there are three reported assassination attempts on President Zelensky were confirmed to have been thwarted by information shared by anti-war elements from the Russian FSB.
It's not the least bit surprising, frankly. What was surprising were the first several days of operations, where there seemed to be some Russian restraint based on very false assumptions on the Ukrainian people's will to resist. But the fact that the Russians are engaging in assassinations is not surprising. The fact that the Russians are going to conduct sabotage operations, the fact that we already see evidence of Russians using ambulances to transport weapons and things of that nature to conceal their activities. I saw another report of hostages that Russian forces are taking hostages. This is not the least bit surprising, and we're likely to see a lot more of this kind of brutality that we don't understand here, but is consistent, if not standard practice, consistent for the way they operate.
Well, one word of caution here is that while I certainly am convinced that Putin would love nothing more than to kill Zelensky, I would be very dubious in believing all these reports from Ukraine about supposedly FSB moles are giving them an advance warning of every assassination attempt. There's a lot of propaganda being pushed by both sides. The Ukrainians are actually being magnificent at winning this information war, even if they may not be winning the ground war. But just be very careful what you believe right now.
Richard Wattenbarger, the floor is yours.
Okay, I think this is probably for Colonel Vindman. What do we know about conscription in Russia? And do they have the process and equipment in place to deploy new conscripts rapidly? And will they do more than minimal training of conscripts, or just throw them out there?
Yeah. Well, I will just say that contract soldiers are, that the theory of contract soldier army is dead. You could see that the Russians are relying at the last minute as they push conscripts across into Ukrainian territory. They're making them sign contracts and things of that nature. And there hasn't even been report. The morale on the Russian side is pretty low, and the reports of the casualties, I don't think they're really that far off the mark, frankly. But of 10,000 Russian soldiers killed, once those start to filter in, right now the Russians have acknowledged only about 500. There's going to be not very great deal of appetite. I mean, there'll be some rally around the flag effect, I think. The Russians are really good at affecting it, but I have a feeling that's going to have a chilling effect on contract soldiers and the folks that they're going to get, they're going to press into the military, whether it's this new legislation on fakes, pushing folks towards the military. They're not going to be the same kinds of troops that the Russians have lost, the airborne forces and the and these kind of tank armies that are their premier forces.
Antti Ruokonen, the floor is yours.
Thanks. So, Colonel Vindman, the Finnish president is currently at the White House. So how do you think that a Finnish or a Swedish NATO membership would strengthen NATO's northeastern flank? And how do you think that a membership of either of those nations could actually support Ukraine? And do you see any downsides to such an move in this current geopolitical environment? Thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to kick it over to Tomas. Of course, it's a good thing. These are very capable military, Sweden and Finland. As to the appetite to do so, I'll leave it to Tomas to judge, but they would be welcomed with open arms, and it could be something that's done very, very quickly.
I do not know what the political decisions will be in Finland because, as I mentioned earlier, I think the populations are way ahead of the politicians who have spent the last 30 years not being for NATO membership, except for maybe Alex Stubb and maybe Carl Bildt. But what it does is it completely changes the strategic picture of Northern Europe, because the problem is right now the Baltic countries are this little peninsula that juts up there. And all we've heard for 20 years is, what about strategic depth? There is no strategic depth. The moment that Finland and Sweden come in, the Baltic Sea turns into a NATO lake with a little bit of that little funny thing there called one that the former Königsberg, the former principality of Königsberg, which, as opposed to the former Soviet republics of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, that then becomes this bizarre anomaly, and you have complete NATO domination of Northern Europe, from Norway to Estonia to Latvia and Lithuania.
Alina, do you have thoughts on Finnish and Swedish accession to NATO?
I was just in Stockholm right after Munich, and I thought one quip I heard then, this was the day, really the day before the invasion, was that, well, we'd be interested, but the Finns would have to go first. And then they said, and the Finns are probably thinking the same thing. So it's a bit of a collective action problem, I think. And certainly the momentum is building, and the Russians, I think, are doing everything they possibly can to convince the Finns to join right now. So I think they would have to act first, but I think Sweden would follow.
The Russians not only have been threatening, but they actually did a mock raid again last week, this week, on Sweden, Gotland, while the defense ministers of the two countries were on the island. I mean, they're doing everything possible to get the two countries to want to join.
Tim Crittenden, you get the last question today.
Well, I am so very grateful for everyone's thoughts and input. It's a great comfort to me to know that you all are thinking and noodling on this. I have many questions, but in the last 24 hours, I'm really curious about how just non-zero, the non-zero chance of some nuclear involvement is in this area. Something about reactor damage through shelling, or if somebody wants to actually engage a tactical nuclear weapon, how would that change the scope in our involvement? I guess to Colonel Vindman and then to the larger group.
Let's just wrap up on this question. Alex, get us started, and then we can just go around and people can give final thoughts in response to this question.
Yeah, as soon as this war started, the non-zero chance of a nuclear war escalated to fractionally above that. So it's a dangerous situation when the largest country in the world attacks the largest country in Europe, and all of the implications of that, including the 15 nuclear power plants, power units. I mean, there's all sorts of different things that that could unfold. What I can tell you for certain is the longer it goes, the more dangerous it gets, because the there's going to be an incrementalism from, I think, Putin's side to continue to test, to continue to see how we could try to squeeze out some sort of win here. And I think there's going to be also an erratic behavior as he feels cornered. If there's any way that we could nudge this towards a quicker conclusion, which means that his forces smash up against the Ukrainian forces, that's happening to a certain extent, but not at a sufficient extent to extend this out. This could get bogged down really quickly. But giving the Ukrainians more capabilities, like a lend-lease type program, where it's not trickling stuff in, but giving him vast amounts of anti-armor air defense capabilities. The French are supposed to come in with medium range anti-armor capabilities, and UCAVs could start to shift this and really just grind down the ability to conduct, to achieve your political objectives with the military aims. Far from there, but that's a potential now.
Thomas?
Yeah, I mean, there's this kind of bit of advice to drug dealers, like don't do your own stuff. And this is the problem, I think, that Putin is doing. He's actually believing his own propaganda. And that is really dangerous, because he thinks he's winning. He's not getting the results. He seriously seems not to believe that his army has done really badly. So, I mean, you're getting high on your own stuff. Secondly, he is erratic. And third, this macho braggadocio of his, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to take it over in a day and a half, which then turns out not to work. I mean, it's kind of typical of the kind of like Gopnik culture of his, he's a Gopnik, which is kind of, I don't know how to explain it. Lena can do it. But in any case, at that point, he's not going to be thinking rationally about this would not be a very good idea to use a nuclear weapon, even if it's just a tactical nuke. He's not constrained by that. And I think Fiona Hill kind of explained it last week pretty well. And I agree with what she says. I mean, he's a Gopnik.
Gopnik, just Alina, please correct me. Dmitry, please correct me. A Gopnik is kind of like a juvenile delinquent, right?
In a tracksuit.
Dmitry.
Like extra trashy kind.
Are we headed toward nuclear war here?
No, I don't think so. I actually think that a lot of people that are saying right now that Putin is crazy, he's a madman, are the same people that never thought that he would never invade. And now they're overcompensated for misreading him by saying, well, he must be crazy if he did so. I think that this was a rational decision on his part, a miscalculation, but nevertheless a rational decision to try to stop NATO expansion, to try to bring Ukraine back into his sphere of influence. And he will accomplish it. Like, I have zero doubt that through utter brutality, they're going to decimate most of the cities in Ukraine and destroy much of that country. They have the firepower to do so. He doesn't need to use nuclear weapons. He doesn't need to use it against Ukraine to accomplish that objective. And he won't do it proactively against NATO either, because he's not suicidal. Now, I do worry that if we trigger him, if we engage in proposals that I think are just absolutely insane, like establishing a no-fly zone, which, by the way, means shooting down Russian aircraft, i.e. going to war with Russia, then yes, you know, once you're in a kinetic conflict with a nuclear power, who knows where it goes. But assuming we avoid that scenario, I don't see any prospect for nuclear weapons being used in this conflict, thankfully.
Alina.
Yeah, but this is the exact mentality that got us to where we are, constantly thinking that no matter what we do is going to provoke Russia. We can't do that. It's going to provoke Russia. Let's re-engage. Let's have a reset. Let's not provoke Russia. Well, guess what? Russia is provoked on its own, you know, and I think we need to stop thinking like that. And I take the point of the no-fly zone. I don't think that's an idea that's going over. What about, as one of my colleagues at SIPA recently said, a we-fly zone, right? Like, we're going to protect these civilian corridors, and you want to shoot us down? Go ahead, you know? I mean, we need to start actually thinking about these kinds of things, because I also think that Putin is rational in a certain sense. He lives in an alternate reality that I believe that he believes, whether that is the propaganda reality or his historical revisionism that he speaks so passionately about, or the whole denazification nonsense that he's been saying, and demilitarization nonsense. But, you know, to be clear, this was never about NATO membership. Ukraine was not going to join NATO anytime soon, and he knew that. Or he was living an alternate reality, and based on the factors in that reality, he is acting rationally. But we live in two different realities. One is the real world, and one is Putin's head. And so from our perspective, of course, it looks like he's being he's making a huge blunder, and he is. I think this is the end of Russia, one way or another. There is no prospect for that country now economically. There is no prospect, depending on how this turns out, maybe even for him as things start to crash in Russia. You know, how is that a win in the long term? It's not. So to my mind, he might get some of Ukraine, but it's going to be painful, it's going to be hard, and it's not going to be this walk in the park, as we've already seen. And that's it. You know, Russia's done. You know, like, it's not going back to business as normal after this.
Tomas, you get the last word.
On this note, I just got a message. Krzysztof Grozev of Bellingcat, who most of you probably know, and who's been very, very good, says his information shows that Russia only has resources until Sunday. And if they don't win by then, they will collapse.
This podcast will run on Monday. So by then, we will know whether Dmitry is correct that the Russians will have successfully encircled key cities in a day or two, whether Alex is correct that they will be bogged down, or whether Bellingcat is correct and they will be out of gas and stuck and maybe encircled themselves. We're going to leave it there. Dominic Bustillos, Alina Polyakova, Dmitry Alperovich, Alex Vindman, Tomas Ilves, thank you all so much for joining us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Hey folks, have you yet become a material supporter of Lawfare? If you do, you can be one of the people asking questions on the next live recording of the podcast. You can do so at our Patreon, patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.